Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel. And we're here today with Dina Feinberg, who is the author of Cold War Correspondence, Soviet and American Reporters on the Ideological Front Lines, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, 2021. Welcome, Dina, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you so much for having me.
So we'll talk here on New Books Network and New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies today a little bit about Dina Feinberg. She is assistant professor in modern history and history BA director at City University of London. Professor Feinberg earned her PhD in modern Russian and modern U.S. history from Rutgers University in 2012. Dina held research fellowships at the Rutgers Center for Historical Analysis, the Center for the United States and the Cold War at New York University, and the Research Center for East European Studies at the University of Bremen. From 2013 to 2016, Dina was assistant professor of East European Studies at the University of Amsterdam. Professor Feinberg's research was published in Cold War History, Journalism History, and several edited volumes. And together with Artemy Kalinowski, she is the editor of Reconsidering Stagnation, Ideology, and Exchange in the Brezhnev Era, published by Lexington Books in 2016. So I want to start right away, Dina, and talk about Cold War Correspondence and what motivated you to get into this research. How did you come to it?
So when I was thinking about graduate studies, I wasn't sure whether I want to become a Soviet historian or a US historian. And so I opted for the Cold War because that was the one area where I didn't have to make that choice, where I could study Soviets and Americans at the same time. This very particular topic started as a seminar paper in the history of US journalism that I did in my very first semester at Rutgers. And for that seminar paper, I read books that American correspondents wrote after their assignment in the Soviet Union. I then found out that Soviet journalists also wrote such books. And so I started reading these books kind of together. And so these were books that American and Soviet foreign correspondents who were stationed on the other side of the Iron Curtain wrote about the other side and about their assignments. And these were very detailed accounts where journalists provided rich descriptions of the Soviet Union or the United States. They talked about their professional and personal experiences. And these books were peppered with kind of great stories and thoughtful analysis of life on the other side. What was really interesting and surprising is how much the books revealed about the journalists' view of their own societies. And it struck me really that an invitation to read these books comparatively and to draw parallels between the Soviet Union and the United States was embedded in these texts, both implicitly and explicitly. So it really interested me that in two such very different political systems and very different media cultures, the same group of people, that is professional journalists, was responsible for representing the outside world to domestic audiences And that as they were doing so, they also reflected on the Cold War rival and on their own countries. I subsequently learned that at the end of the Cold War, the work of American and Soviet foreign correspondents had been assessed differently. And so American reporting from the Soviet Union was and still is remembered as an accurate and very objective portrayal of how things were. Soviet reporting from the United States was depicted as propaganda that on purpose misrepresented reality and cast it in negative light. And that was really surprising to me because my reading of these books showed that things were not so clear-cut and that associating one set of journalists with truth and the other with lies just don't do justice to these sources and to the way these people wrote. And I was really interested that Soviet and American correspondents like claim to be speaking the truth. And I decided that these claims should be taken seriously. And one of the central questions in the book is then what truth meant for American and Soviet correspondents and how their claims to speak the truth produced diametrically opposed narratives about what the Soviet Union and the United States were really like. And kind of working on this project was, I realized that this project offers a vantage point into many things that interested me as a scholar and as a person. Representations and imaginations of self and other, the relationships between personal and collective identities, the role of media in society, and what was it like to live through the Cold War and be personally involved in the events that we associate with the Cold War. And as I worked more on this, I also realized that this project is also about the relationship between news media, ideology, and foreign policy. And this is also another angle that I examine in the book.
So, Dina, I'm really interested. I think that's a good opening statement. Maybe you could talk to our audience about your understandings of truth and lies and journalistic practices and how, let's say, the truth of meaning, the truth of facts, the truth of representations, as Natalia Rudakova and others have written about, affect your journalists and how, you know, this sort of changes over time during the Cold War.
So one of the things that made international reporting special in the Cold War and made international reporting as a special site of Cold War knowledge production is that journalists belong to a profession where truth-telling was both a requirement and a source of legitimacy. So both Soviet and American journalisms claim to bring the truth to people and claim to speak truth to power. They both claim to adhere to professional practices and truth-telling standards. But the way that journalists on both sides understood truth and the way they understood speaking the truth was also shaped by their respective professional and political cultures. And I am using a lot of Natalia Rudakova's work here, and I want to thank her for shaping my own thinking on these matters, both with her book, but as through our conversations. Natalia had been incredibly generous to me for many years and was very influential in my work. So establishing and accurately reporting facts are and were central to American journalistic practice. Another thing that was central to American journalistic practice is the distinction between professional journalism and fiction, and the distinction between reporting the news and interpretation. And the central kind of premise in the truthfulness of American press is this idea of journalistic objectivity, which imagines journalists approaching the world as disinterested realists and to the best of their knowledge, providing the public with an unbiased account of reality. And this idea also translates into several professional practices that were designed to ensure the objectivity of the press. So, for example, presenting multiple sides of an issue, identifying something as a fact only when you can support it with verified evidence. And again, distinguishing reporting, that is what happened, from interpretive journalism, that is from analysis of what happened. In the Soviet Union, the Soviet press really self-consciously projects and incorporates socialist ideology and values. Soviet journalists imagine themselves, like Soviet writers, as engineers of human souls. That is, people who shape the citizens of socialist society, educate and enlighten them towards becoming better socialists. And again, as Natalia Rudakova's work shows, Soviet journalists considered factual accuracy to be of secondary importance to the moral truth of socialism. And then as a result, as again, she shows that Soviet journalistic practices often borrowed from literature and featured different kinds of techniques, like selective presentation of material, like speaking to your readers also as a person through your articles, like sharing the process whereby you arrived at the story and the moral values that you present in your story, describing your protagonist's inner worlds and kind of really a lot of narrative enhancements that they use. And so one of the central features in Soviet journalism is this thing called ocherk, journalistic essay, which is a short contained story that has kind of a moral value to it, that has an additional meaning, that aims to tell you something about kind of the universe, the larger kind of issues and moral and universal issues through a focus on specific individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to come back to a lot of that because I think our listeners might be familiar with some bureau chiefs and U.S. journalists who have their missions to Moscow. And, you know, you do cover a lot of the big figures like Harrison Salisbury, for instance. But maybe you could introduce the Russian side or the Soviet Russophone side. Who are some of the journalists that you found most interesting? And then, of course, you know, how did you go about and do the research and get their, you know, archives and papers and those sorts of things in order to examine their practices and personalities?
This is a great question, and thank you. So most Soviet journalists who cover the United States throughout the Cold War were actually pretty new to journalism. They were young people during the war, and immediately after the war, they usually became students in all these elite Soviet institutions that are rapidly producing cadres for international work. And there are, the central institution for this is MGIMO, Moscow State Institute for International Relations. Another important university is MGU, Moscow State Institute, Moscow State University, sorry. And these people are, these universities are training people for the expanding Soviet international apparatus, which at the end of the war, for a set of reasons, lacks people who can speak foreign languages, lacks people who have deep knowledge of foreign cultures, and kind of the Soviet international apparatus is expanding and it needs people. One of these expanding areas is international departments of Soviet newspapers that really need young journalists who can do all these things. So many of my protagonists trained in MGIMO, and some of the people, some of the Soviet people that I follow throughout in the book are Genrikh Baravik, Stanislav Kondrashov. So Baravik was a correspondent for Novosti Press Agency and Literaturnaya Gazeta. Stanislav Kondrashov was a correspondent for Izvestia. Melor Strua, also a correspondent for Izvestia. Boris Strelnikov for Pravda. And I also touch occasionally on others, people such as Valentin Zorin, who is probably more familiar than others in the West. So what unites these people is that they were trained in these institutions in the early 1940s, and all of them kind of arrived to journalism by mistake. So, for example, Boravik has stellar grades. He's facing a very bright career in the Soviet Foreign Service, and then two recruiters from the intelligence come to interview him, and they notice his very unusual patronymic, which is Aviezrovich. And so they ask him, what is that patronymic? And he says, oh, it's a Jewish name, means with God's help. So the interview finishes. They said, oh, we're going to call you. They never call him. And so he's effectively facing this really unusual Soviet situation of being a graduate of a super prestigious institution without a job lined up. This is the late 1940s or 1950s. The anti-cosmopolitan propaganda campaign is in full swing. And so Boravik is looking for work. And he finds work as kind of a junior editor in Oganyok, effectively. Oganyok is the glossy Soviet magazine, effectively initially editing the captions of the pictures. And the way he finds that job is through the help of his friend Boris Strelnikov, who is another hero of this book, who is at that time a junior editor in the international department of Komsomolskaya Pravda. And after Stalin's death, these young men are promoted to very prestigious posts of Soviet correspondents in the West. And there was a clear hierarchy, kind of Soviet newspapers assigned greatest value to international reporting from capitalist countries. And these kind of New York, Washington, Paris, London were the most prestigious posts to have as a Soviet correspondent. So many of these relatively young journalists got promoted to these super important posts in the early 1960s. What they did between 53 and kind of before taking these posts is they served in smaller international posts. So they would go to conflict zones and foreign countries. So, for example, Stanislav Kondrashov first goes abroad as a correspondent on the Suez Crisis. His reporting from the Suez Crisis is so impressive for Izvestia editors that they appoint him as the correspondent responsible for Middle East and North Africa, which is a huge area, and he lives in Cairo and travels around. He spends there 5 years and then takes over the very prestigious post of a New York correspondent for Izvestia, and he will remain in this post for years. So there are a lot of kind of these stories of people who were not necessarily fitting or chosen for careers in foreign service and who arrived to journalism and made really, really distinguished careers in Soviet international reporting. And they spent... What is also interesting about Soviet correspondents is that they had spent many years reporting from overseas. So, for example, Strelnikov would be Pravda's correspondent in the United States for 15 years, which is a very long time. Kondrashov had two assignments, 6 years and 7 years long. So, again, these were really long assignments that shape these people's professional lives and understanding and sense of belonging and so on.
I guess, you know, I'm really interested in several personalities. Strelnikov and Kondrashov, I think are so important at the heart of your book. I mean, I love the story even about Melor Starua who stops his car. I think this is in the 60s. They're all under FBI surveillance. He gets lost on one of his trips and then goes and asks the surveillance team for directions. So I guess, you know, I was sort of really interested in their missions, the missions especially of the Soviet correspondents in the United States, where they can go, what they can't do. Obviously, you know, they're refused by bureaucrats and officials. They can't visit southern states. I mean, how does that evolve over time? And how do you see that reflected in some of the research that you've done through their memoirs and private papers?
So it evolves it was interesting, and it wasn't in tandem with the restrictions that are confronted by American correspondents in the Soviet Union. So the treatment of Soviet journalists in the United States and American journalists in the USSR is governed by rules of reciprocity, which means what you do to us, we do to you. We're going to have 20 correspondents, so you can have 20 correspondents. We're going to delay visa to Strelnikov, so somebody else's visa, American's visa, is going to get delayed. The areas all journalists, Soviet journalists, could not travel to particular areas, and the geography of where it is they could and couldn't go evolved together with the Cold War. So the restrictions were pretty severe in the early years. They could not move more than 40 miles radius, behind 40 miles radius away from their place of work, which means the capital for Washington correspondents and the UN building for New York-based correspondents. And again, these restrictions kind of mirror the restrictions that American journalists are facing in the Soviet Union. Then as the relationship between the two countries improves and evolves, so do more areas open. Still, Soviet journalists had to approve to submit their itineraries in advance to the State Department and the Justice Department, and they had to have special permission to travel to particular places. There is a map in the book which shows where it is they could go and where it is they couldn't go. And sometimes whether or not they could go places really depends on the whim of a handling official. And so the example that I give in the book is that Kantoshev wants to go to the Deep South, but he's not allowed to go to the Deep South because the person handling out his application thought it would be ill-advised to let foreign correspondents see what's going on and kind of have eyewitness access to these to the racial disturbances that happen in the Deep South. Now, the way to find out about these things, and this was probably the hardest part of my research, because the Soviet archival record is very much incomplete. For instance, the Pravda editorial archive was closed to researchers for the entire time that I worked on this project, and is still closed to researchers today, as far as I'm aware. A lot of personal papers is not something that could have been very easily accessed. So to get at them, it was a combination of reading their memoirs and the things that they have published. Interestingly enough, American sources on dealing with Soviet journalism, Soviet journalists in the United States, were quite in abundance. And so to understand the U.S. side of things, I could actually follow through State Department documents. But also in several cases, I was super fortunate that two of my main protagonists, that is Baravik and Sturua, are still alive and were much younger when I started the project. And so I had very excellent interviews with them working on this research and trying to understand how things were. Boris Strelnikov's children generously spoke to me for this project as well and shared memories and photos and things that they had. And finally, Stanislav Kondrashov's son allowed me to work in his father's private archive, which was amazing and kind of not even a tip of an iceberg of this archive made it into the book, unfortunately. But it was a very rich source that also helped to understand. So between all these different types of documents, I could follow the individual stories of the journalists and to try to tell about their experiences as people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I see this, you know, really humanistic dimension, if I may say so. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there seems to be a lot in common that the correspondents on both sides had, despite all of their anxieties and mutual suspicions. They're very interested in the character of the average American, or for better or worse, the character of the average Soviet citizen. And there's a whole lot of essentialism and stereotypes there, but I mean, how do they begin to reach their audiences as part of the thaw generation and beyond in telling their stories and getting to the realities, if they can, of everyday life?
I think they start with articles, and these would be kind of longer articles on small aspects or small curious aspects of everyday life. And this is something that indeed begins in the thaw between 1945 and 1953. The reporting is very much lacking relatable or recognizable Soviet or American characters. So American reporting is, again, about the Soviet system very, very broadly. And the only personal experiences that you get is the personal experiences of the besieged foreigners in Moscow. In Soviet reporting, you get these kind of giant aggregates of people. So the suffering toiling masses, the oppressed racial minorities. So again, you don't have actual living people, only kind of a lot of slogans and masses. Systems are more prominent in reporting before 1953. And after Stalin's death, there is a great opening and much interest in reporting about everyday life and everyday life as it is lived on the other side of the Iron Curtain, because each side had spent years being frightened of each other, thinking that there is a nuclear war with these people. So who are these people? Are they going to attack us? What kind of people are these? And they really want to know. The questions start from the journalists themselves, but also their audiences. What kind of people are there and what are they like as people? And the most basic questions are, so how many kids do they have? Do they have pets? Do they go to the movies? How many rooms is there in the house? What's in their shops? What do the kids learn at school? So really kind of basic questions. And you see how journalists start answering these basic questions. First in articles, that would be, you know, occasional walking away from summits and international developments and just talking about the regular lives of people on the other side. And later on with books. And a lot of journalists wrote books about the rival superpower. And it worked really well for them because it allowed them to explore all these questions and to talk about all these issues without being confined to news relevance, without being confined to the length of columns, to really reflect on, you know, the national characters, us and them, what kind of people they are. And the more we progress with the years, the more of these books are published. It also does an interesting thing. For example, in the United States, this is in part a response to the rise of television and radio as a competitors to the printed press.
I so wanted again, to ask you about that. Yeah, please.
How would your list, you know, beat these media being relevant, and they choose to do so by providing these in-depth accounts? Same, interestingly, happens in the Soviet Union, only that the competition is actually foreign radio stations, which are seen as competing with Soviet press for audiences and providing information. And so both sets of correspondents in different ways start to establish themselves as experts on the rival superpower. And we see throughout the Cold War on both sides this rise of a journalist as an expert and as a pundit, somebody who is knowledgeable about the other side, who becomes the source of knowledge that is interested and accessible and that people really, really like to read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a couple of great examples. I wonder if you could talk about Smith, you know, Hedrick Smith, the Russians, and then his sequel, The New Russians, or perhaps Robert Kaiser. That's another really good example, at least on the U.S. side, the American side. Their ideological biases and how that reflects their long-form reporting. I mean, there are other examples later on, like David Remnick and eventually The New Yorker. But, I mean, I'm really curious in how someone like Smith or Kaiser change, if they change at all, in their understandings about eternal Russia and the Russian character. I mean, why do you think their work is so popular, and what sort of prejudices or biases or practices do their works reflect?
Wow.
It's a big question.
It is a big question. Hedvig Smith came to Moscow in the summer of 1971 to head the Moscow Bureau of the New York Times. And his book, The Russians, became an international bestseller that was reprinted in several editions. It was it really had kind of an incredible life, this book. It was assigned to college students in the United States. People read it as a guide before going to Russia. People in tour agencies in the United States would give this book to people who are bound to the Soviet Union. And another famous journalistic personality and a famous book of the time is Smith's counterpart in the Washington Post, that is Robert Kaiser, who also comes to Moscow to head the Washington Post Bureau in 71 and stays pretty much the same time. And their books come at the same year, pretty much head to head. Kaiser's is called Russia, the People and the Power. I have thought a lot about these particular books in my research. And they both made an effort to travel around and to speak with as many people as possible for their books, and to provide a really kind of comprehensive picture of what Russia is like. And I interviewed both of them for the book, and each of them said that what they were interested in is what the kind of stuff that they couldn't read in academic books, the kind of stuff they couldn't read in the newspapers at the time. What these people are like, why are they like they are, what's going on there, and to really kind of understand the Soviets on their own terms. And I think the two books are really exceptional in their breadth and their depth and in their effort to provide the comprehensive analysis of the Soviet Union and Soviet national character, and really kind of reflect on the Russian national character. So there are biases in these books, and these biases would be sort of unavoidable. For example, these are American journalists, and they're very much interested in consumption and the state of Soviet shops, because this is something that plays a role in American culture, because Soviet-American competition for 20 years has been unfolding along the promise of delivering similar lives. So the Soviets have promised their people to deliver similar lifestyles as the United States, and this starts with Khrushchev. So they arrive, 20 years into that promise, and of course they're interested in everyday life. Other biases, again, they are there. And for example, one of them is this idea of a Potemkin village. And this is not just Smith and Kaiser. So this idea that whatever Soviets are showing to foreigners is actually a carefully crafted veneer that is there to disguise something, the real shabby state of things. Another one is this idea of eternal Russia that I speak a lot about the book, that effectively Soviets are not, because Soviets are Russians, they are not fit for democracy and they don't do democracy, that they prefer and feel much more comfortable with totalitarian, authoritarian regimes. And this is why you cannot change them. So this idea that Russia is unchanging, that it's eternal, that it's, this is how it is, and this is how it will be. And they use these old notions to explain to their readers and to themselves why the Soviet Union is the way it is. And so they tap into these explanatory frameworks that exist, that are there, kind of that circulate in the United States and in the West more broadly regarding Russia.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you, Dina, because I'm fascinated by how you set up your parts. You have four parts to the book. So I should have mentioned this at the start. Part one, Spires versus Liars. I love this title, 1945 to 53. Part two, Pens Instead of Projectiles, 53 to 65. Part three, Your Fight is Our Fight, 65 to 85. My favorite chapter, I think, is Notes from the Rotten West. And then part four, A Moment of Truth, from 85 to 91. Did you have that chronology in mind? Were you going to set up breaks, like, you know, the break after Khrushchev is retired, or the break after Gorbachev comes to power? I mean, what made you arrange it that way?
What made me arrange it that way is kind of major. It's a range around times where international reporting changed, or when kind of a new chapter or a new clearly distinct chapter was introduced into international reporting on both sides. Because of how their respective political systems work, a lot of that change and these like big watershed moments, they actually were framed by whoever is in power in the Soviet Union. Right, so very clearly, Stalin's death, for instance, is a giant watershed moment in the history of, you know, the Soviet history, in the history of Soviet internationalism, in the history of Soviet engagement with the world, and also in the history of international reporting. Stalin dies, and the journalistic practices, both Soviet journalistic practices, change a great deal. Soviet treatment of American correspondents changes a great deal, pretty much overnight. And this is a big watershed moment. The second watershed moment is less, and I placed it in 68. And this is because really 68 is kind of symbolizes developments that are building up until then. So 68 is the year of Prague Spring, major dissident cases in the East. And 68 is the year of discontent in the United States, and the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and of Robert Kennedy. And 68 is an important year because journalists on both sides start realizing that the society that they had covered for many years and that they thought they had known is actually surprising them. And they were really surprised on these challenges from within, from these challenges to the Soviet system and these challenges to the American system. And they realized that they need to factor them into their reporting and to make sense of these complicated developments. So it is challenged from within, but the rival superpower is still standing. What's going on? How do we understand all that? And this really kind of spurs a new distinct chapter in the history of international reporting, and not a coincidence, I think, that the best books and most books were written after 68. 85, again, is a kind of natural watershed moment, because we know that with the arrival of Mikhail Gorbachev, Soviet-American relations, again, transform very swiftly. And so does international reporting transforms again.
Yeah, and I did want to ask a question about the Brezhnev era, because I know in your other work, the argument about the dynamism of the 1970s, in the U.S., it's something of a dreary decade, at least that's my kind of popular imaginary of it. But I'm really intrigued in your book, because there is, of course, the great suspicion about U.S. journalists in Moscow getting a little too close to the dissidents and dissident culture. I wonder if you might, talk a little bit about what happens in the long 70s, let's say, so from 68 to 82 or 85. How do these journalistic practices on both sides of the Cold War change over that time, if you see them changing at all?
I think in this period, they really... it becomes very clear, this whole notion of comparative writing and reading about each other. And so, and this is where kind of one of the main arguments of the book comes from, is that during this period, journalists start writing comparatively, but they are inviting their readers to compare Russia or the United States, not with their real home country, not with the realities of what's going on, but with the utopian and the beautiful version. So the Soviets are inviting the readers to compare the United States, not with the existing Soviet Union, but with the Soviet Union where socialist utopia will be realized. Similarly, American correspondents are writing in such a way that invites their readers to compare the Soviet Union with the United States of the American dream. And we see this kind of comparative writing really coming into its own during this period. And so it invites journalists to think about their values and the ideas of their own countries and what makes them unique. And to criticize, we see both sets of journalists criticizing the enemy while being silent about the shortcomings of life at home. And so Boris Dernikov, who is a Pravda correspondent, he goes to a West Virginia mining town that has now lost all its residents because all the people who lived in this town left, except the town's one last resident, who is also becomes the protagonist of Strelnikov's story. So Strelnikov tells you, you know, a very traditional tale about new technologies coming and replacing the miners because the capitalist owners are trying to save money. And so all these people were driven to poverty and destitution and had to leave. And it is a story, on the one hand, that it's a story of one person, the human interest story. On the other hand, that it's a story about capitalism and exploitation of workers and expropriation of workers, etc. Now, somebody like Strelnikov is surely a very smart man. And so he surely, and so do his readers, know that the lives of Soviet workers are not great. And there are mining towns in the Soviet Unions where things are not wonderful. But there is this invitation embedded in that story to compare West Virginia not with Soviet realities, but with Soviet ideals, right? To compare these values or the absence of values and support for the worker in the American system with Soviet declare commitments to look after its workers and to make sure that they are never destitute or poor. And this is not lying. This is just inviting your readers to think about the ideals of their own country. And in American reporting, again, you see the same kind of movement. You see Americans are being critical about things like the Soviet healthcare system, which is free of charge and available for all, and about the Soviet education system, which is, again, government-owned and pretty much free of charge, and about, you know, very affordable, if not free, housing. And so they find things, they find aspects to criticize about these things, and they write a lot about how these things are imperfect and how these systems are malfunctioning. But at that very time, for many Americans, something like healthcare, education, and housing is a very faraway dream. It's not accessible and not available. Again, you know, this is the late 1960s, early 1970s, kind of US first recession that is happening in 1970s. We know everything there is to know about inequality in the United States. And still American audiences, again, are invited to not to think about these problems that exist in the United States, but to imagine, kind of to contrast these Soviet things with ideal American things. So what would the America of the American dream look like? What kinds of things Americans would kind of could enjoy in principle in the American system? And so you can see that these biases and these methods of subjective comparative writing actually play out for Soviet and American correspondents alike at that time.
Mm-hmm. I'm really intrigued. You know, this is probably going to be the final question content-wise, but how you wrap up the period of new thinking, glasnost, perestroika, and then in your conclusion, I find this absolutely fascinating. You begin with RT, the Russian television channel, in 2017. I know I have to go there and ask you a question because this is, you know, the age of this quote unquote real journalists and fake news. And there seem to be precedents and maybe even Russophobic precedents to the kind of policies that that were exacted or at least introduced in America to bar Russian journalists from access. I wonder if you might explain this, because that there seems to be another book that you could write about the era of citizen journalism and digital media and new media really up through the 2010s. So what made you write about that?
Right. So on the one hand, the 80s is this really exciting moment, right? When there is a lot of the context between people on both sides are much more immediate. There is much excitement about what's going on, and people really want to know more about each other and start. And there's also a period when there is a very conscious effort on behalf of the journalists to try and abandon these old stereotypes and to start writing in new way. They really kind of, they were on both sides, they were willing to work towards these goals. At the same time, there was also this persistent feeling that it is the Soviet Union that needs to learn something from the United States. There was also a little bit of disparity, which is Soviet people were much more interested in America and knew more about America and Americans than vice versa. But at this particular time, there's like a subtext of Soviet-US relations where there is a implicit assumption that the Soviet Union needs to change, it needs to learn something from the West, and therefore earn goodwill and trust and good attitudes from the American public opinion. So we can already see in this period that the extent and the levels of mutual excitement were slightly different. The information and how both sides understand information had played a big role in what we call Russiagate, so in the declining relations in these past 4 years. It is also very visible that on both sides, information is associated with national identity, and the information emanating from hostile power is perceived as a big national threat. And again, these particular tropes and these particular ways of thinking about each other were developed in the Cold War. And it is in the Cold War that information and the press and journalism become really central to how Americans and Soviets understand their national identity and understand what distinguishes them from each other and speak about these things. Now, I don't think that we can blame news media or media on everything that is happening or that had happened kind of, you know, between 91 and until today, and certainly not in these past 4 years. But for somebody who had been thinking about the role of news media in Russian-American relations and had been studying this for many years, there had been a lot of callous attitude to reporting and to coverage and to work with evidence and what kinds of things were allowed to go into reporting, the kinds of things that it was okay to publish, that really contributed to this decline in trust and to mutual dissatisfaction and to anger and to all these things that we are seeing today.
Yeah, thank you. I think especially the conclusion, people should read your part about ideology and how ideological baggage persists and operates both in the Soviet case and in the American case overtly and covertly. So I want to just conclude, since we're running out of time, Dina, if you might recommend two or three other books for our listenership here at New Books Network, and perhaps, you know, just tell us a little bit about your current research and projects.
So the books I would like to recommend is Natalia Rudakova's aforementioned Losing Pravda, which is a fantastic story about the transition of from Soviet journalism to Russian journalism and what happens to Soviet journalism upon the collapse of the Soviet Union. I learned a great deal from this book. It's beautifully written, and I think it's really, really important for understanding kind of this later period, understanding Russia today, but also understanding this post-truth culture in which we operate today and which is so much on our minds. The other book I'd like to recommend is To See Paris and Die by Eleonore Gilbert. It's most exquisitely and beautifully written book about Russian relations with the West, Soviet relations with the West, that I had the pleasure to read. It is fantastic and so insightful, beautifully written, really highly recommend for understanding this period and kind of the broader context of Soviet imagination of foreign countries. And also maybe Ilfan Petrov's Little Golden America. That is the American travelogue that Ilfan Petrov wrote in 1937. It's the account of their American road trip. One of the most striking things about Soviet reporting in general is that how many of their reports could still be relevant to this day, or how many of the observations that they had made, whether before or during the Cold War, you can still see them play out in the contemporary United States. And I think it's a really refreshing attitude and a very refreshing look at America, which is both sympathetic and critical at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And maybe your current research or projects, what are you interested in and working on next?
So I'm very interested in where we ended this conversation and where the book ends. I'm very interested in the period of Glasnost. And I want to know more about this, and I want to know what happened and how it shaped both how Soviet media changed during that time, how it changed in relations, in relationship and in dialogue with international media and various international actors, and ultimately how that period of Glasnost and that freedom of information shaped what happened in Russia in the 1990s and after the rise of Vladimir Putin. I think that the press was a very big player in these stories, and this is something that I want to know more about and I would like to write about as well.
I will read that. And, you know, I mean, thank you so much for writing this book and for doing all of the research and interviews. It's such extensive research. I can't possibly do it justice in a podcast. But thank you, Dina Feinberg, for joining us today on New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It was a pleasure.
It was a joy to talk to you. And for our listeners, we've been speaking about Cold War Correspondence by Dina Feinberg, Soviet and American Reporters on the Ideological Frontlines, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, 2021. Thank you so much again for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It was a pleasure.
And I'm Stephen Siegel here at New Books Network. Until next time.